The following presentation is brought to you from the supporters of the Church of the Sovereign God.
When it comes, that's a fill in the blank, when it comes, then comes shame, but with the lowly is wisdom. This is Proverbs 11 and verse 2. In the Bible, this topic that I said, fill in the blank, that I intentionally didn't tell you what it is depicted as necklace, a crown, and its fruit. It is also shown as to oppress, to testify, to deceive, and to bring low. By many different individuals, biblical scholars, it is considered to have been the first sin. And the reason that is considered to have been the first sin is because it is the sin that caused Satan to fall from his position as an angel of light. We also understand that it is the very same sin that Satan used to draw Adam and Eve away from their being in the presence of fellowship with God there in the garden. Satan also still uses this same sin to tempt all of us. In the poem, The Divine Comedy, Dante lists this sin along with six others. You would probably know the seven deadly sins, and if you're, you know, former Catholic, you might know what they are. But anyway, they are listed, and I'm not necessarily, this is the order in which they give them necessarily, but the sins would be lust, envy, gluttony, greed, sloth, wrath, and this other one. Theologian and writer C.S. Lewis, I realize I'm just giving you a bunch of points right now and facts, and I understand that, but I'm built upon to what the topic is going to be, wrote about this sin in his work that is entitled The Great Sin. I mean, that's how he pictured it, as the great sin. He states, it tempts all of us, and yet we despise it when it is found in everyone else. He also goes on to state that it could not exist without competition, and the reason is because it basically is competitive. And he says simply another way to describe it would be rivalry. And the American statesman Benjamin Franklin wrote about this topic in his autobiography, and I will quote, "There is perhaps no one of our natural possessions so hard to subdue as blank. Beat it down, stifle it, mortify it as much as one pleases, it is still alive. Even if I could conceive that I had completely overcome it, I should probably be proud of my humility." End quote. So what is this sin? It is pride. Or conceit, arrogance, egotism, self-importance, vanity, superiority, a lot of other things, and I think we get the point. Webster's dictionary lists six different meanings or usages of the word pride. I'm going to give you three of them here because I think these are the three that more important that we would see and understand. Number one is the quality or state of being proud, as in inordinate self-esteem or conceit, or a reasonable or justifiable self-respect or delight or elation arising from some act, possession, or relationship, such as a parent over a child. Number two, proud or disdainful behavior or treatment. Number three, flamboyant or flashy display. Now, I think we all need to think about ourselves, you know, as we're going through here, and I included. I know that we all have some tendencies toward this particular sin, and that's why I think it's so important. I think it's why it's important for us to take a look at it. Now, with these statements in mind, I want you to go with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 4. 1 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 6. And these things, brethren, I have in a figure transferred to myself and to Apollos for your sakes, that you might learn in us not to think of men above that which is written, that no one of you be puffed up for one against another. It's just describing pride. Is, you know, we can do it in that one simple word. Now, with that in mind, go to Galatians 6 and verse 4. Galatians 6 and verse 4. But let every man prove his own work, and then shall he have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. So what are these verses that we've just read? What do they tell us about pride? Well, there's a lesson that we can see from just these verses, and I think it's pretty clear that the lesson is that pride relies on competition, and without competition, there is no pride. Because it is simply a comparing of self with someone else. I'm better than you are. I'm this over you. My school is better than your school. My pension plan is better than your pension plan. Or whatever it is, there's some type of competition, comparison going on here. And I think we just saw that it's pretty clear that we're not supposed to do that. I mean, just from these two verses we've read, I think that we could come to the conclusion. Now, but we're not done. So now I want you to go to 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 12. And this is Paul, the apostle, speaking again or writing here. For we commend not ourselves again unto you, but give you occasion to glory on our behalf, that you may have somewhat to answer them which glory in appearance and not in heart. So again, we ask the question from this verse, what is it that we can see about pride? Well, what Paul is saying here is, because he is talking about himself and Apollos again, and he's saying that they were not trying to commend, as it says, or to praise themselves is another way of saying that. They're saying we're not trying to praise ourselves, but he says that he is giving to the members an opportunity to take pride in what Paul and Barnabas are doing. You go, whoa, now isn't that wrong? Well, we're going to see. So he's saying that he's giving them an opportunity so that they can take pride in Paul and Barnabas, so that they, the members, could answer those who take pride in what is seen rather than what is in the heart. Because I think we need to understand, pride in someone else is not necessarily evil. In fact, I think the scripture is pretty clear, and we're going to read all of these verses, but I think it's pretty clear that we should be proud of those who are living steadfast in God's will, who are living godly way of life. We should be proud in that sense. That's the right thing. We just saw that, in fact, in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 12. That's what Paul says. You can also look at, we're not going to go there, but in 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 4, and 2 Corinthians 8 and verse 24, and read the verses around all of those chapters and see if that's not what that's talking about. Having pride in someone else because they are living the godly way of life is an okay thing. We can, in other words, be proud of someone else and still be living the godly way of life, still be living in God's will. However, when we start living outside of God's will, then what happens is we usually take pride in what is seen, in other words, the physical aspects of life, as opposed to the spiritual aspects of life. And that's where we start getting into major trouble. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians again. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verse 4. Now you know this. You know 1 Corinthians 13 is what is called the love chapter, right? Okay, well let's take a look, because right in here it is talking about it. 1 Corinthians 13, 4. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud. In other words, pride is not lovely to God. Pride is not love. Therefore, pride is sin. At this time, I want us to read together. I mean, you can follow along with me, and I'd like to read several different passages where we can see what God has to say about pride. We're not going to read all of the verses in the Bible. We're going to read several of them, and I think we can get a good feel for what God actually has to say about this particular topic. And I want us to go through, and as we're reading these, I want you to pay attention for a verse that says pride is sin. Because I just told you, it is sin. And I want to look for a verse that says that in this list of scriptures we're going to read. Let's begin in Psalm 138, verse 6. Though the Lord be high, yet hath he respect unto the lowly, but the proud he knows afar off. What that is saying is he has a distance from, he stays away from those who are proud. You ever been in a situation where you reacted in some way based upon pride, self-importance, or whatever, and then afterwards you felt a distance from God, maybe? Well, that's exactly what he says. He stays away, afar off from. Proverbs 8 and verse 12. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence, and find out knowledge of witty inventions. Verse 13. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride, and arrogance, and the evil way and the froward mouth do I hate. So God is very plain. It says, wisdom says, well, that's personification of God. And it says, I hate these things. And one of those things he says is that he hates is pride. Proverbs 16 and verse 5. Everyone that is proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord. Though hand joined in hand, he shall not be unpunished. I think there's enough information here that every one of us by the end of this could get to the place and say, you know what? I need to change. I need to make some changes. And it has to start with me. Because you can't start saying, well, you know, that person is a very proud person. They need to change and they need to repent of that. Excuse me? That's just another definition of proud, of being proud. And it's exactly what we're looking at. Proverbs 18:12. Before destruction, the heart of man is haughty, and before honor is humility. Other translations use the word proud or proudful. Proverbs 21:4. A high look and a proud heart and the plowing of the wicked is sin. Verse 24. Proud and haughty scorner is his name who deals in proud wrath. Well, all of this is Old Testament. There's nothing in the New Testament. It's okay now, right? No. Romans 12, verse 16. Be of the same mind one toward another. Mind not high things, but condescend to men of low estate. Be not wise in your own conceits. Remember, conceit is another word for being proud. 2 Timothy 3, verse 1. Now, we know that 2 Timothy 3, this is where it says, this know also that in the last days perilous times shall come. You think being proud is going to be listed in that? What's going to be happening? It's going to be coming more and more alive at the end of the age? The answer is yes, it's exactly what we're going to see. Have people had it all the way back from Adam and Eve? Yes. Is it going to be even what we might want to call rampant during the end of the days? And the answer is yes. 2 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1. Know this also, that in the last days perilous times shall come. For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, without natural affection, truth breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good. Remember, we said a while ago, it's okay. It's probably a positive thing to be proud of someone who's doing good things because it's away from self. And here it says, at the end of the days, it's going to be people who are going to despise those people that are good. Verse 4. Traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying the power thereof, from such turn away. Stay away from them. And one of those things is pride, conceit, self-importance, those kind of things. James 4 and verse 6. James 4 and verse 6. But he gives more grace. Wherefore he says, God resists the proud, but gives grace unto the humble. One more in this long list that we're going to read. 1 John chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15, we begin. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Okay, now are we going to see that one of the things that the world does is has this particular problem we're dealing with? Well, let's see. Verse 16. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life is not of God, but is of the world. And the world passes away, and the lust thereof. But he that does the will of God abides forever. So, is it also saying that those who do the will of God are going to last forever? And just to get it down to our topic today, having this prideful attitude is not going to last forever? I think that's what it's saying. I think that we can see this. Now, did you notice the verse that God tells us that pride is a sin? It was back in Proverbs chapter 21 and verse 4. A high look and a proud heart and the plowing of the wicked is sin. So I think that we can see it keeps company with some really bad other sins. And it's mixed right in among them. It's not like in the list that it's the first one listed or the last one listed and you can go, well, it's not as important a sin as these other. No, sin is sin. It is a sin. And as Ben Franklin says, it's one of the last things that we want to get rid of. I mean, we all got it. Yet we despise someone else when it comes up in them. And that's just another definition of being proud or being self-important. Now, with all that we've said so far, I want you now to go with me to Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9. The setting for this incident is shortly after Jesus sent the 12 disciples out to minister to the Jews or to Israel at that time. We also notice that it is shortly after the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000. And it also is the day after the transfiguration. Now, I'm not reading all of the events up to this. I'm reading this one happening. So there was a lot of things that took place. And there's purposes in putting it in connection with these other things. Okay, we also remember this event, this transfiguration event, occurred on a mountain. We also know from the story that Jesus took with him Peter and James and John. And those three apostles all saw Jesus appear with Moses and Elijah on the mountain, and they heard God speak. So I'm going to start with the record where it picks up as they come down from the mountain the next day. So I'm not focusing so much on the transfiguration. I'm telling you the timing of this. Okay? He had sent them out. They had come back. He has also already fed the 5,000, that miracle, and now this transfiguration, and it's the next day, and it says they're coming down. Luke 9, verse 37. Luke 9, 37, I'm going to read it in the New International Version. It has it more in a story flow, and I think it actually kind of jumps out on the page at us as a story, as opposed to just Bible verses, if you follow what I'm seeing. Now, you can read it in any translation, but you'll still get the point, but I think it's pretty clear here. Verse 37, the next day when they came down from the mountain, a large crowd met him. A man in a crowd called out, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is my only child." A spirit seizes him, and he suddenly screams. It throws him into convulsions so that he foams at the mouth. We get the point here. We get the picture of what's happening. It scarcely ever leaves him and is destroying him. "I beg your disciples to drive it out," but they could not. Verse 41, Jesus speaks. "O unbelieving and perverse generation," Jesus replied, "how long shall I stay with you and put up with you? Bring your son here." Even while the boy was coming, the demon threw him to the ground in a convulsion. But Jesus rebuked the evil spirit, healed the boy, and gave him back to his father. And they were all amazed at the greatness of God. While everyone was marveling at all that Jesus did, he said to his disciples, "Listen carefully to what I'm about to tell you. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men." But they did not understand what this meant. It was hidden from them so that they did not grasp it, and they were afraid to ask him about it. Okay, now if we just pause right here and you say, what an incredible story. But we're not done. Let's continue reading. An argument started among the disciples as to which of them would be the greatest. That is what we do. I mean, just put yourself here. And if you think, oh, I would never do that. Well, you know what? You know what that says? I think you know what it says. Jesus, knowing their thoughts, took a little child and had him stand beside him. I know what others says, put him in his lap, and I think there's a better translation there. But anyway, then he said to them, "Whoever welcomes this little child in my name welcomes me, and whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me. For he who is least among you all, he is the greatest." I mean, there are so many situations that are happening here. The blessing of the little children, in one sense, is all part of this. And it's in that context of the disciples arguing among themselves who's going to be the greatest. It's pride. The only problem is this is not the only occurrence of this problem where the disciples argued about who should be the greatest. Let's go to Luke 22. This particular story takes place the night when Jesus was betrayed. In other words, this was the Passover. And it occurred just after he had revealed this fact to his disciples that he was going to be betrayed. Now, he'd already told them. He's telling them again. Let's begin reading in verse 20. Again, I'm going to read in the New International Version. "In the same way, after the supper, he took the cup, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood, which is poured out for you. But the hand of him who is going to betray me is with mine on the table.'" I know the others are a little different in a way, and I'm not trying to establish that point. I'm looking at the story here. Verse 22, "The Son of Man will go as it has been decreed, but woe to that man who betrays me." The next verse. "Then began to question among themselves which of them it might be who would do this. Also, a dispute arose among them as to which of them was considered to be the greatest." Verse 25, "Jesus said to them, 'The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who exercise authority over them call themselves benefactors. But you are not to be like this.'" He just said, don't be this way. And what was the way he's talking about? Who's the greatest? That's pride. "Instead, the greatest among you should be like the youngest, and one who rules like the one who serves. For who is greatest, the one who is at the table or the one who serves? Is it not the one who is at the table? But I am among you as one who serves. I mean, he's making a comparison. You want to make a comparison here. Look at what I'm doing. Look at how I am, because I'm like the one who sent me. This is what he is saying here. And it is in the context of their comparing themselves among themselves, which is, says, not wise. You are those who have stood by me in my trials, and I confer on you a kingdom, just as my Father conferred one on me, so that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Yet we're not done. And we're not picking on the 12 disciples. I think we all respect these men greatly, and it's recorded for us in the Bible for us to learn lessons. Because yet there is another record that is found in Mark chapter 10, just after Jesus tells his disciples that he is going to be betrayed and be killed. The Bible tells us that James and John came to Jesus and said, can we sit on your side, one on the right and one on the left of you in the kingdom? And of course, we also understand that Jesus told them that it was for those to whom it belonged that was being prepared, you know, for that. He was not saying, no, you can't. But we also know that there was great problems as a result of this. Now, were there so much prideful in the sense? And I know in the context of the story, we understand it was actually their mother who asked it, you know, but then again, she did it on behalf of those. Were they the ones who really were filled so much with pride? Was it the mother? Or was it the other disciples who got upset with them because they wanted it? Now, personally, I find it amazing that the 12 apostles, they would argue about who was going to be the greatest. Why do you think this occurred? Well, there seems to be a pattern for us to consider. In Luke 22, we read the story of the Passover, and the dispute about who would be the greatest among them arose just after Jesus revealed that he was going to be betrayed, and he's telling them, and tonight is the night. Then in Luke chapter 9, the same argument follows Jesus' revelation that he would be betrayed. And as we also see the same pattern in Mark chapter 10, when James and John ask if they could sit on both sides in the kingdom. So what is the pattern? What is it that we're seeing? What is it we're to be learning and considering here and learning here? Well, I think the pattern that is revealed is that the apostles had lack of understanding of some things. One, the type of kingdom Jesus was referring to. They had a lack of understanding. His focus was on the spiritual and not on the earthly. The second thing is that Jesus would still be their leader. And the third thing was that servant leadership is the model. I want us to think about this for a moment. These men had Jesus Christ as their teacher. They had Jesus Christ as their spiritual trainer, shall we say, for 3+ years. They walked with him. They slept where he was. They ate what he ate. They shared things in common. What does this say about us? About all mankind? I think that we would probably, pretty much all of us would agree and believe that if any group of people in the past who have ever lived would have been the ones who would have resisted the devil's temptation of pride, it would have been Adam and Eve, or at least the 12 disciples. So what is the lesson that is being taught to us? What is it telling us about ourselves? What it is telling us is that we too are tempted to give into pride because we're no different than our forefathers, Adam and Eve, and the 12 disciples. If they were walking with God, as it were, and they did this, they were tempted by the devil, and they gave in to it, what about us? Because we are all inclined to falling into the sin of pride. I want us to summarize at this point what I would consider to be the main points of this sermon on pride. One, pride is a sin. Number two, pride relies on competition, comparing one to another. Number one, pride is a sin. Number two, pride relies on competition, comparing one to another. Number three, pride was the first sin. I agree in that statement. In a technicality, was it? That's not my point. I think it could be considered that it certainly was. Then we know that he lied. We know that he was a murderer, because we know the first sinner was Satan, and we understand that. I think when you go into look into the prophecies, and it talks about it, and he says that he wanted to rise up and be equal, as it were, to God. I think he was in a competition. I've said this before. I think that he felt that he was in a comparison, and he put himself in a place of comparison and a competition with the being that we refer as Jesus Christ, because I think that's who he was wanting to replace. Well, I'm as good as he is, type thing. So number three, pride was the first sin, and as a result, it obviously has brought all kinds of sorrow, every sin, on every mankind who's ever lived. Number four, all are tempted by pride. Main focal point number five, we can be prideful or we can walk as a righteous believer. Because Jesus said, this is the way they are, but this is not the way I want you to be. Number six, servant leadership is the model. It is the example that Jesus Christ revealed and set for us as believers. I mean, there we read it, there at that Passover service when he said, well, who's the greatest, you know, the guy who is serving the table or the one who's sitting at the table? And he said, well, I think we would all understand it's the word who's sitting at the table. And you're all sitting with me, and I'm here as a servant. So servant leadership is the model. And that's what he revealed, and that's what he set for us as believers. So is there an antidote for pride? Yeah, there is. When we start thinking too highly of ourselves, there are some things we need to think about. There are some things that we need to have that we can call to our remembrance and call them up, and we can have them there. The first one that I think that we need to remember is we did not and we cannot pay the price for our salvation. And the second thing that we need to remember, however, is it has been paid for us. It was already paid. We can't pay it. Somebody else paid it. And that somebody else, of course, is Jesus Christ. Then the next thing is by remembering the incredible, awesome love that God has toward us. Then there's a passage of verses in the Bible that we need to recall and we need to go to and start reading. We need to go to the book of Philippians. And there what we're going to see is what our attitude should be. And we see the incredible, breathtaking example that God gave for us. That's the antidote. So let's go to Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2. And we're going to read verses 5 through 11. And I'm going to read this in the J.B. Phillips New Testament translation. Philippians 2, 5 through 11. Verse 5. Let Christ himself be your example as to what your attitude should be. I mean, we can stop right there and say, so is our attitude to be one of being prideful? The answer is, of course not. Verse 6. For he who had always been God by nature, or as it is in an alternate translation says, for he who always had the godly nature did not cling to his prerogatives as God's equal, but stripped himself of all privilege by consenting to be a slave by nature and by being born as mortal man. And having become man, he humbled himself by living a life of utter obedience, even to the extent of dying, and the death he died was the death of a common criminal. That is why God has now lifted him so high and has given him the name above all names, so that at the name of Jesus every knee shall bow, whether in heaven or earth or under the earth. And that means those that are dead is what that's implying, and being resurrected. All are going to do this. This is the point that he is making here. And that is why, in the end, every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is the Lord, to the glory of God the Father. I think in this sermon today, I think we've heard a great deal of information about the topic of pride. However, having said that, I also understand that we have not heard a lot about the solution. So we conclude the topic of pride today this way. We are not the center of it all. The center of it all is Jesus Christ. Therefore, we ask, what do we have to be prideful about? If I'm not the center of it all, and Jesus Christ is the center, then what is there that I have to be prideful about anyway? The Aaronic blessing. And the Lord spoken to Moses, saying, speak unto Aaron and to his sons, saying, on this wise you shall bless the children of Israel, saying unto them, the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. And they shall put my name upon the children of Israel, and I will bless them.
For more information or answers to your Bible questions, please contact the Church of the Sovereign God. Our website is www.cotsg.org. That's www.cotsg.org. Or you may write to us at Post Office Box 89111. That's Post Office Box 89111, Tampa, Florida 33689.